So for this special event, I want to welcome our guest, but I'm actually going to invite our own Odin to excuse me, Odin Halvorsen to introduce our guest, because he's the one responsible for bringing him here to Many Rivers Books and Tea. And so, without further ado, Odin Halvorsen.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I've been really excited to introduce the Democracy Cafe to Sebastopol. Democracy Cafe is Christopher Phillips' brainchild. He has a number of remarkable books that you should check out if you get a chance over here. The impetus behind Democracy Cafe is to create a space where a form of dialogue can take place that removes the need for partisan division. We can sit down, we can have a dialogue in the Bohmian style rather than a discussion, an argument where someone has to win. And that drew me in immediately to this style, this Socratic style of dialogue. Because right now, in the world overall, regardless of any specific national political situation, we have a sort of tumultuous time. There are people who disagree with each other very, very strongly. And regardless of what side you happen to be on, what side, I believe that it's very important, in fact it's of ultimate importance to the future of our species, that we sit down together, face to face, not online, together in the same room, and meet one another. So, without further ado, I am very, very happy to welcome Dr. Christopher Phillips to Many Rivers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. How are y'all doing?
Good.
It has been 20 years since I last drove through this area. I started Socrates Cafe, built on it a bit when I was living in the San Francisco area 20 years ago during the dot-com boom. I'm so delighted now the prices have gone way down. Right? No? But it's such a beautiful area to come through. Can you hear my Tidewater Virginia twang? Yeah. I think Odin said somebody had to leave early. I've already taken it personally.
Yeah.
So I just want you to know I just can't tolerate that. But yeah, I started Socrates Cafe almost 20, no, over 20 years ago. My gosh. Gosh, time flies when you're sort of doing what you want to do, even if you don't make any money. But it's thrilling. You know, I was telling Odin that my master plan had been to just have one group where I was living at the time, at first in Montclair, New Jersey. And this was during the second term of the Clinton administration when he was undergoing impeachment proceedings. And that even if someone whose view I, you know, was pretty kindred with, if he heard some, or she heard a view that was alien or differed, then they just started, you know, jumping down people's throats and just trying to proselytize without really trying to understand one another's stories for how they arrived at whatever view they did arrive at. And I was discouraged by a lot of the things I saw on TV and public radio, even, whether it was billed as a exchange or discourse, when it was really just he who interrupts the most and browbeats the other and speaks the loudest and humiliates the best wins, whatever that can mean. And I was discouraged. I have dual U.S. Greek citizenship. My yaya, my Greek grandmother, they immigrated through Ellis Island, where their last name was summarily changed from Philippou to Phillips. You know, she became the first Greek teacher of Greek culture and language in the Tampa Bay region of Florida. She never really liked the U.S., but she felt like, well, at least I could tell people all about Greece. She was a big influence on me. She thought that someday I would do in modern context, you know, what Socrates did of old. And I was really little at the time, and I thought she was a little wacky. But she taught me two terms. This is my heart, and there's two Hellenic Greek words here. This is meraki, which is to live. Everything you should do with passion and soul, with all your being. Everything that you take on, from the mundane to the more ambitious. And this is the term arete, in arete. There's no literal translation. I write about these terms in all my books, sort of theme and variation, like a symphony, I guess, where it's to live a life of all-around excellence. But with an ethos in which duty to others and duty to self go hand in glove. So if there's an age suddenly emerging of increasing narcissism and pure self-aggrandizement, well, that's counter to this ethos. And so what do? You blame and declaim, or do you try to do something about it yourself to maybe make just a tiny bit of difference? So this one group I started in Montclair, Socrates Cafe, was sort of an exercise or a journey towards arete. But giving, you know, using Meraki to sort of try to develop a new ethos where we inquire together, we encounter one another, we all have different stories to share and to tell, and what we need is just to listen and hear each other out. We may leave more entrenched in our own view at the end than we were at the outset, but what's transformative is just actually listening to somebody else and really inquiring into what speaks for and against any given way of seeing things. Maybe there's elements of rightness and wrongness to lots of different points of view if we hear one another out. Maybe not, but the only way to know, I think, is to hear one another out. And so I do sort of make the assertion that what the world needs now is a lot more careful listeners, where we're not always just trying to think up our next zinger. So, and that's really, I mean, believe it or not, this book, The Philosophy of Childing, that just came out. Have you heard of this term, childing, before? I hadn't either. I wrote this book, I guess I should pay them royalties, because of a dialogue I held in an elementary school in Iowa. But it turns out that there was really, when I discovered this term, really sort of sums up the culminating philosophy of everything that I strive to do. I do recount a number of my experiences holding dialogues, particularly where I used to live in Chiapas, Mexico, with indigenous children there, dialogues that I held with children in Hiroshima, Japan, dialogues that I held for years at Cesar Chavez Elementary School in the Mission District of San Francisco, where kids may not have great grasp of the traditional three R's, but their grasp of reasoning, the fourth R, but it was like an empathic reasoning, where they really wanted to hear one another, where they were coming from, was transformative for me. It changed my entire approach to philosophizing. It quickly became non-hierarchical, where they gave me the sense of fellow feeling, that we're all in this together, and it behooves us to listen carefully to one another, and it sparked me eventually to travel around the globe, to try as much as possible to hold dialogues that include people of lots of ages and walks of life. I just came, this was my fourth visit. They raised funds again for me to go to Mount Shasta, which was perfect, so it enabled me to come here. But they've had me there now 4 out of the last 6 years, and we got together like at the Mount Shasta Library, and just kids from about 5 years old to probably about 85 years old, children at heart, one and all, we gathered and inquired with one another. It's just become a really beautiful tradition there. But after all these years, I think I still like doing it so much because I never fail to learn something, or rarely fail to learn something new about myself. It takes a lot of chutzpah to offer your view these days in a public setting with people who haven't been vetted beforehand. I mean, really, it takes a lot of guts. It does. But it's a beautiful thing to see children latch onto this method. It's like second nature to them. I've really come to feel that they are so caring. Almost hardwired to be caring. There may be always exceptions to the rule, such are we humans, but by and large I've found that to be the case. We have a Facebook page, it's called Democracy Cafe. You'll see, if you do that on Facebook, you'll see this coffee cup that has a Democracy Cafe in the sleeve, and you'll see people sticking out of the cup like french fries. Actually, it's right there. Yeah, it's got Jefferson and Socrates and Dewey and lots of other people. 60s protesters sort of with the bullhorn, and those kinds of things too. But really, to me, it's about democratizing. When we get together, especially in public places and spaces, if we can feel passionate about our points of view, but also feel passionate and enthused about hearing other points of view, I think we all win. And if we can not just, if we can get a little bit beyond a typical confab where it's just, here's what I think, without necessarily supporting our view, but feeling it incumbent to share the story behind how we arrived at our point of view, then I feel like we've all won again. You know, so I started this in the Clinton era. Now this is 21 years later, and I'm so happy to report that we've all come together as one. You're laughing at me. Are you laughing at me? Why are you laughing? Should I take it personally? What? What did I say? You don't think we've all come together as one? Why? What's the problem?
To me, it's an amoeba effect that we're going through.
Tell me about that. I've never heard that before. Amoeba effect. Tell me.
It seems as though at times of stress, humans tend to form a bubble and they split off. And I call it an amoeba.
They form a bubble and split off.
Right.
I sort of assert in my Socrates books that when Greece went into its period of decline, that virtue became vice and vice became virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And so we closed ourselves off. They closed themselves off.
Yeah.
No longer really wanted to hear other views. And that was led to what turned out to be an irreversible decline.
Yeah,
yeah, so the amoeba effect. That's, can I steal that?
Yeah, sure.
No, that's really cool. Yeah, so then for me the thing is, how do I quit blaming others and how do I look in the mirror and say, what can I do if I feel like this is unnerving and could be deleterious to our what was meant to be a fairly open constitutional republic of a democratic bed? What can I do? You know, and so we all these. If you go to our nonprofit page at SocratesCafe.com or democracycafe.org, it's all about sort of taking a more foundational approach. Because I feel like, well, how are we ever going to really tackle hard button issues if we don't feel some bond or connectedness from the get-go? Yeah, so we have to feel some sort of uncommon common ground of some sort in order to maybe be a little, not flexible or compromised, but maybe reach a higher ground where it's not all about my way or the highway.
Right.
But that, you know, that would take a level of trust that maybe we don't have in one another right now, to put it mildly.
Yeah. And ourselves, I think that's part of that splitting is that effect of like disassociation with reality.
Yeah, and it can be in many different ways and guises, from, you know, the deeply individual split, fracturing within.
But the nice thing about it is that is life.
No, yeah.
Okay, you have to give me a second here. Just forgive me. I don't want to get in your talk, but I would like to share with you just a few pieces I've learned.
Okay.
And let you be taking this forward if you're interested, only because I think it's so crucial. And here it is. The professors are up here at State University, mm-hmm. are collecting information since 1976, and there's a verification of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's an intentional line deceiving mm-hmm. to do a divide and conquer, just mm-hmm. so you know, it's
yeah.
a divide and conquer in America.
Yeah.
It's been going on for decades,
yeah.
like 40, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's becoming important is it turns out in the United Nations there's what's called a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have rights that we never knew existed since 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And the conquer and divide has separated, so we now no longer realize that we weren't given our rights and we don't even know they exist. So when we're embracing each other, which I absolutely believe in, we somehow have to get back over to the Universal Declaration, because what's happened is we now have half the country that has been taught to go up against our ability to have rights. And that's
mm-hmm.
so if you're at all interested, you can research it and share it.
Yeah.
Because we need to not just, you know, embrace each other, mm-hmm. but we need to know we have rights that got left behind in 1948 That's all.
Well,
and
you
it's
know,
massive because it's in order to have a democracy. Otherwise, we won't have one.
One of our initiatives is called the Declaration Project. And if you go to declarationproject.org, it's the biggest online comprehensive declarations of rights of independence ever compiled.
Yeah, and this one's better than our Constitution,
yeah,
though.
But so that it's one of the declarations that's on it.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful.
The but what about this point? How many of you feel, you made a really important point, how many of you trust the information that you're getting in order to make decisions?
Lies everywhere.
Lies everywhere, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you go out and look for different perspectives, you can hunt it up. I mean, I do trust that, I feel like with some training, we have the ability to evaluate sources.
Okay.
And so, there's a whole bunch of junk out there.
There's a whole bunch of junk.
But it's not all junk.
But how do you, I mean, do you feel, I was talking to a person about this the other day who is sort of a First Amendment advocate. And he was saying, you know, it's quite often we're fed news that's packaged. This is setting aside the world of alternative facts and fake news and all that. But even from so-called legitimate sources, quite often the sources that they use are not as... they're depicted as objective, but they're not necessarily. That there's sometimes, I don't want to get too, this sort of a deeper shadow state that gets paid to feed information that's packaged as legitimate.
I believe in listen to everyone, but don't believe anyone, mm-hmm. including myself. Keep the question open. Mm-hmm. Never. When you answer a question, it's like slamming the door shut. Just always continue to receive more information.
But you feel like if we do our homework, we can...
I mean, like we have in Santa Rosa right now, there's Measure C for rent control. And I don't look at the flyers from the pro-Measure C people, and I don't look at the flyers from the anti-Measure C people. I go out and do kind of a... inquiry and like look at how well does rent control work in general and mm-hmm. talk to different people, and it's not like a source. If it's important to me, because mm-hmm. I can't keep an internally open mind on the question of rent control, I got to vote on it. So I'm going to at some point.
So where do you go for your.
Where
do
I go?
To get like more triangulating information that you would feel is maybe not a purely objective, I don't know if such a thing exists, mm-hmm. but where you're getting, you know.
I read the letters to the editor of the Press Democrat, uh-huh. the local paper. I read editorials online. I look at a lot of Facebook stuff, and then I go and ask people. And I'm talking about individuals who either have a strong position one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
Talk to them, and then sort it out.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I was going to do the same thing because I'm new to the area, and then I finally caught who funded the whole thing. And it's like a national real estate group, and I thought, okay, that answers that.
Well, how did you find that out?
Because I read it. It's right there. It's right on the literature.
Okay.
And so it's a very clear orientation. It's the real estate people trying to block local something.
Okay. Yes.
Oh, you saw my phone. The inner stirring. My great hunger is to find a conversation where I belong.
Mm-hmm.
I like calling it the conversation of my soul.
With your foe?
My soul.
With your soul.
The conversation of my soul.
I see.
Just of my soul.
Uh-huh.
And in that search, I've develop certain terms like radical equality. Like when I notice that people who are not particularly verbal can hold the attention of the group really, really easily, whether they're talking or not, you know, that there is a kind of a healing.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to do with searching for our collective body. The body that we share, the consciousness that we share. And I'm not sure why I'm bringing this up. But one of the problems has to do with overvaluing one voice, and when we like in school, we're taught to overvalue the voice, I think, of the teacher, and it causes us to undervalue our own voice. So we have to start searching for the value of our own voice, and that can take and that involves a healing. If you've undervalued it, that's a wounding, and then we have to. So the relationship between conversation and feeling is really important to me.
Yes.
I'd like to kind of hit on what you said a while ago about when virtue became vice and vice became virtue, because my take on it is exactly that. That before, you know, before Socrates was around, there was the Greek mysteries, God of Light, Apollo. These are things Socrates was into. He was into virtue. He had his God that he was with him to, you know, lead him along his way. And this kind of thinking had a lot of very virtuous aspects to it, with ethics and justice and all the things that are in Plato, that really developed democracy, and it was based on virtue and goodness. And I think I just would wonder what you think today, and how, if that, I believe, first of all, I believe that is the birth of democracy, and Cicero even said that, he commented that the mysteries was responsible for the end of the barbarians and the development of basically democracy. So what do you think about that in terms of today for the development of...
Well, I'll tell you something he did that was really radical for his time. You know, the powers that be were not used to being questioned and challenged. And so when somebody who was in a position of authority, including those who sentenced him to be executed, when he asked them simply why, that was considered really rebellious. I mean, just merely asking them why. They consider that such a radical, if not heretical, challenge to their authority. That really upended things. And when he modeled that for young people, you know, he was charged with impiety to getting the youth to think that they didn't have to pay a know-it-all, you know, sophist a pretty penny in order to have their wisdom dispensed from them. You know, his basic message was, well, you can be your own best questioner and thinker. You just have to develop a method and take responsibility and ownership and do the homework, which takes a lot of effort to examine a wide variety of sources. I mean, if democratic citizenship is to prevail, it takes a lot of homework. His notion today, I think, extrapolating from that, would be that we need to become well-versed in nuclear policy, environmental policy. We need to be exercising our freedom of information responsibilities if we feel like things are being hidden from us, or those things will just dissipate. But taking back, you know, what the world needs now, I mean, the last enlightened generalist in the medical profession is probably a GP, general practitioner. I mean, most people now are just, in every field, are really hyper-specialists. But in addition to our specialties in whatever field, he would assert that we need to become more and more enlightened generalists again, too. Because otherwise, experts will take over. And there's an expertise in being an enlightened generalist. It takes a lot of hard work to become versed in the issues and the policies. A lot of people will try to talk over you and use highfalutin jargon. I mean, I have 3 master's degrees and a PhD, so I know what I'm talking about. I swear to God that people use certain terms in my fields that they have not the slightest earthly idea what they're talking about. But they use it as a cloak to intimidate, obfuscate. Is it always the case? No, some they're just horrible writers. But all too often that is also the case. And so I really think that we need to resurrect that tradition that, I don't know if I would call it a Socratic tradition of becoming an enlightened generalist and feeling like we've got to do our homework, or anything can be foisted upon us. I mean, just the fact that it's becoming harder and harder to distinguish between real and fake news. I feel sorry for Andy Borowitz now in New York, where he actually has to put legally, not the news. Like, we're no longer capable of distinguishing satire from the real deal. That's what it's come down to, because there was such a broad dissemination of so-called fake news. Did you read about how the French in the political elections partially combated it when they knew they were going to be hacked? They deliberately planted fake news and fake exchanges within the correspondences that were hacked. You know? So fight fake news with fake news so you can't distinguish the difference between the two, so that nothing can be held against you in a court. But that's, I mean... Yeah. So I think, though, that but becoming more discerning and being able to see who's promoting or promulgating this viewpoint, even if they're very well-intentioned souls, but if it's being packaged as objective, still ask yourself, is it as objective as it's painted, especially if you find it agreeable. To make sure that you're also looking for maybe some fairly viable objections and alternatives. But I truly believe that if open societies live and breathe by enlightened generalists, and I do believe that some of the most potentially promising ones are our youngest citizens. Yeah. And they're more open and inured to that. It's their wiring to be that way. Yeah.
I was wondering, what happens, one thing you're talking about, a lot of time to become that generalist, but then what about getting down to just where the values are different? Because one of the things, just to use the rent control, for example, as an example, mm-hmm. one of the things about learning about both sides more intensively is it's hard to go and say they're just, that side is evil or that side is just brainwashed. And they, you know, you sort of can see both positions.
Yeah.
But there are basic values differences
yes.
at the very base of this. So when
yes.
you get down to that values difference, yeah. then what? How do you carry that?
Well, there's a number of things I might say. I mean, I like to assume that everyone, when they're bandying a point of view, is operating from a position of a sincerity, that they sincerely hold that view. Until and unless I have really sound evidence to believe otherwise. And sometimes that's... So, I think that it's important to understand, I'm not saying that there's right and wrong, that all views are right or all views are wrong. What I'm saying is, let's hear the side out. Let's find out their sources. Let's respect them enough at least to give equal consideration to their view as those I find agreeable, patently agreeable. And then I'll decide that this is just totally wrong. But not until and unless I really do that and willing to give that equal consideration. So I worry less about persuading others about my way of seeing things, and I can focus more on what I call self-persuasion. You know, persuading myself based on the evidence at hand whether this holds water or not. And that, honestly, I don't know any shortcuts. It takes a lot of work, whether it's in a scholarly sort of treatise or whether it's an issue like this. I think it takes a lot of hard work as a citizen to really... before arriving at a tentatively hard conclusion about which path to take, but a lot of times, and just like you pointed out, it's some things are being packaged as fairly objective, especially, and if it's in a view that we find sort of patently agreeable to begin with, then we might be a little less on our toes than otherwise. But I think that may be when it's even more important to be on our toes and to make sure. It's all it's claimed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that we'll alter our viewpoint necessarily. It just means that we did a lot more homework. And I think that there's a lot of really cool things arising right now. I started off my writing life as a journalist at a family-owned newspaper in rural Maine. You know, and it was an amazing thing to just sort of do a lot of gumshoe work on my own and realize,
mm-hmm. yeah.
It's a to really appreciate what it is to be a journalist, there's a lot of, as newspapers, as the traditional newspaper industry is just nosediving in most cases, there's been an uprising, an upwelling of citizen journalism. Lots of movements that otherwise wouldn't have received coverage from the major media began with focus by citizen journalists, including Occupy. I mean, that they got totally short shrift at first. But there were a lot of citizen journalists using social media to not say that they're for or against, but that this is happening. You know, just to get coverage of where they were going to build the pipeline, was in North Dakota. Again, it got no media coverage at all from so-called major media outlets until the citizen journalists in the front lines were the ones just using social media any way that they could. Again, not saying, not trying to ring the alarm, but just saying this is happening. Just to find out something is happening. I mean, how do you even make a decision on anything until you even know what's happening? So I find the rise of citizen journalists, quite often from professional journalists who lost their jobs with the traditional capitalist media, they decided that still it was in their blood and bones to do this, and that there's a really democratic necessity for this. So many of them live on a wing and a prayer to just say this has happened, which I find, again, I think we need lots and lots of sources of information and conduits of things. So then, because otherwise, there's no decision to be made because we don't even know really about it. Yeah. Yeah.
Back in the '60s, I found it really interesting to hang information that I found important on telephone poles.
Like, what would you like? Tell me. Give me an example.
Chief Joseph's speech. I can't even remember at the moment. But it's very moving, and it's very heartfelt, and it's very human. And I saw it as a truth that we were missing at the time in all of our dialogues. We were leaving out the, how can I say it, just because someone doesn't believe the way I do doesn't mean that they don't have a heart and they're loving. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like the drawing in of when people stop and read something in the street, they tend to turn around and say, did you see that? Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, it's kind of like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And I found doing that when I went to poetry readings or any kind of a gathering where people were trying to converse in a friendly manner, the subjects that were within the things I hung in the telephone pole would come out. Mm-hmm. It was really, how can I say it? It took away from the falsification in a lot of the magazines that were out, even though they were progressive magazines. Mm-hmm. I was finding a lot of angst, a lot of, like, let's fight. Mm-hmm. And that was not the purpose. Mm-hmm. Making sense anymore.
No, it makes perfect sense. I would like, what do you think, if we had back then the kind of social media that we have now, would that have made a difference back then?
I think it would have made a tremendous difference. The problem back then, though, was that, how can I say, it's like now we've got like the Tower of Babel. We really do. When I used to work in San Francisco, I used to always go to this one bus stop, and it always smelled like piss. And the people who were walking around talking to themselves were nuts. I went there 20 years later, same bus stop, I'm on my way to a different place to work. Everybody's talking to themselves. The little things in their ears. Yes, that's the Tower of Babel. And back then, I don't think that would have formed because we were still reading, we were still talking.
Yeah. I have to say I've been heartened by the fact that there's been a growth in physical books.
Yes.
And e-book sales have taken a nosedive. So maybe that's a harbinger. I don't know. Now, when I first brought this up and I talked about, how many of you feel like you, in any issue that's of concern to you, that you feel like you can access a plethora of facts and perspectives in order to make an informed decision? Do any of you like feel like your things are still being withheld and that there's just, or that you really feel like you can...
I'm thinking of WikiLeaks. It's like an incredible source of probably reasonably accurate information, but which I have to agree, we have to just discern those things.
There's no middleman. It just comes through raw material, right?
Right. So yes, social media. As you said, we have to discern.
Right. But does there always have to be an Ellsberg, somebody willing to put everything on the line, risk being jailed, to get us information that otherwise would be withheld from us?
Not anymore.
No?
No. I think it's coming. I mean, I think the information's there. It's just...
I have a question. Why can't there be some consequences to faulty information? If this is making people go crazy because they can't trust anything, and just listening to, why can't there be consequences? Why do they get away? Well, let me ask you, rather than, are there consequences to actually purposefully disseminating faulty information?
I mean, what is fake news?
Yeah, so there are no consequences.
Right. Should you have to say...
But should there be...
Should you have to say, this is fake news and flashing lights, if you're creating the impression that this is news to consider and swallow...
Why are there no signs?
Is there, yes.
Well, that would mean that lying would be against the law, and that undermines the First Amendment.
Okay. There's what if there was a really fascinating article I read during the Brexit debate that so much of the information that was being disseminated by the major media was in fact being fed to them by what ostensibly were legitimate sources, but what it turns out months after the vote was being fed by folks with an agenda who wanted Brexit. But there was no, they just couldn't, that was where the funding was coming from.
Money speaks.
Huh?
Money speaks.
Yeah.
I watched an interesting video about search engines for information. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we can't only do so much to control the actual information if we're thinking that you're the First Amendment. But search engines, they claim that they will give you the most legitimate matches for your answer, but in fact they give you what they think you want to see so that you'll keep reading.
Uh-huh.
Because if you keep using their search engines.
Interesting.
Facebook, Google, all these things. So their responsibility to, if you type in a sentence, what do they match with that?
It's incredible.
They want you to keep on digging. They want you to
hear what you want to hear. Yeah.
So what do you think about that?
I think it's so wrong.
Chilling.
Yeah.
Is there something we can do? I mean, otherwise, yes.
The Tor browser, something that doesn't keep cookies.
Tor browser.
There's the apps.
I have.
Tor is the browser, and the corollary would be Signal for texting, only because it's more secure. But yeah, to actually go on to figure out from the security experts, how can you get information without it matching up all your past 25, 80, or 100 searches?
Yeah, I had this Kafka-esque experience on Wikipedia. Whoever is the first one to put information about you on Wikipedia, then it's like up to others to correct it. But if the first set of information is not objective or clear, somebody put up some stuff about me. Number one, I don't have a middle name. They put Christopher R. Phillips. And they put this weird amalgam of stuff and half-truths. And I finally, there was nobody to write to. There's nobody to contact. I didn't want to do it myself, but finally somebody who apparently was really thoroughly familiar, you cannot go. I told you that. How dare you?
Here's the professors.
Oh, okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
You're wonderful. Thank you.
I know. I just had to say that.
I'm sure you are.
You have to ask. I became a dad late in life. I've got a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old. You'll have to ask them if I'm Mr. Wonderful. They sure miss me when I'm away for more than a few nights. I know that. So that's probably a good sign. Well, I wonder... if anybody wants to see this really thoroughly researched article that I read about Brexit and the real sources, just I'll give you my email. It's Christopher_Phillips@mac.com. I'll send it to you. You can decide for yourself. But it was is disturbing, to put it mildly. Because this is what a lot of their major... Yes, yes. Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes, you.
Well, in discussing the change that social media has brought up, I grew up during the Vietnam War, and I was imprinted on that. And one of the things I used to do is I always watched Bill Buckley's Firing Line. He drove me crazy. But my memory is that he gave them time to say what they wanted to say. He didn't browbeat them. He would sit there and he was sarcastic. He could wither people with a look.
Yes.
But he actually gave them time to make their points, and then he'd go, but for me, that's the biggest contrast today, is that there's not this space, I'll say something in a conversation and I can't get, two full sentences off before, a ton of withering comments comes. And I think that's partly due to the change in media. William F. Buckley was, early television? Is that fair to say? It was live, or taped live. But my observation is, I have relatives who are very conservative. And we grew up together, my cousins and I. So I know how to talk to people. We have these conversations where we don't agree. I know it can happen. But it seems harder and harder to make it happen. I'm not coming to a great conclusion, but it feels to me that something has been lost, between the era of the Vietnam War and now.
Well, I hope you've said everything you have to say, because I'm not coming back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, but you brought up the Vietnam War, and this is something I write about in Constitution Cafe, Jefferson's Brew for a True Revolution, is that the Gulf of Tonkin incident that precipitated our involvement, our massive involvement in the Vietnam War, was fabricated.
Yeah.
It never happened.
Right.
It led to tens and tens of thousands of our troops being maimed and killed on a fabricated incident that because Johnson wanted us in that war. Because top secret information is kept top secret for about three decades, we didn't find out about that until decades after, and so many lives have been traumatized and lost because of the fabricated Gulf of Tonkin incident. How can we ever make a decision about something when we don't know what's what? I mean, it's absolutely proven. I mean, it was revealed by this top secret classified information that it was a pure fabrication. And yet, if they can do that, and if they don't have to back it up because they can say this is top secret, I don't have to reveal it, then I don't know what that portends for an open society. I just don't know. I mean, what do people do? I mean, the Constitution makes no mention whatsoever of classified information, top secret information. The people have the right to freedom of the press. What do we do about that? Once these things start morphing and when things are withheld from us so people can do what they want to do, who have the authority and power to do so. I'm speaking to somebody who has great faith, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't. But how do we ever, can we ever just say we shouldn't do anything until we really know what those who are at the highest echelons of power claim to know? I feel a little preachy, but that was absolutely revealed that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was fabricated, and there was no way we could know that at the time. Yeah.
Two things. One is we don't have an open society, and I think we can just acknowledge that.
Right.
The other thing is that anybody that's in a position of power, I find suspect. I don't think they have my interests at heart. They have other interests at heart, and I'm just suspicious of it. And it's just I don't say knee-jerk, automatic reaction on my part to question it and to doubt the validity of the truth of what they're saying.
Is there a way to make a not-so-open society more open? Does it start off with a sort of a skepticism? If we're not, I mean, how, if we're told this is the information, but we have, there are no triangulating sources whatsoever. It was just a series of people saying this is what happened, take my word for it.
Well, I think skepticism is a fundamental approach. I mean, I'm skeptical about my perceptions, about my own ideas, about what I believe. It doesn't take me much to extend that skepticism to those that are in power who I don't believe have my interest at heart at all. And there's not necessarily any reason that they should. And so there's conflict built into that situation right from the start.
One of the ways that would be nice, I'd like to see happen, would be to have things like this in parks with kids at schools, elementary schools, start there. Because I think that's one of the biggest underminings that's happened since the Vietnam time period is the decimation of knowledge.
Right.
And how to, how to see it.
Well, that's exactly what our nonprofit aims to do, and that's what we do. I will post lots of our exchanges in Mount Shasta. I had about 25 over 3.5 days. I went to, but you know what? There's gatekeepers, so you have to have administrators. You have to have teachers who want exactly what you just stated, because lots and lots don't. So how do you do that? You make inroads where you can. You know, if one opens the door, hopefully somebody else will come and see it. Hopefully it will dispel concerns about it. And they'll go, wow, thank goodness they overcame such and such as doubts and let us come in and do that. Because otherwise, I don't know how you make a not-so-open society more open. Because there's gatekeepers. I mean, one of the last great bastions of fairly democratic inclusiveness that I have found in my journeys across the fruited plain here in the U.S. is libraries. It's the one place I've discovered where, by and large, virtually anybody from any walk of life feels fairly comfortable coming into. My favorite places to hold these kinds of inquiries are in the children's sections. And we older folks will sit in the uncomfortable seats. And kids, I'm doing one, and I'll put it up on our Democracy Cafe page on Facebook, on in Tacoma Park, Maryland, which is a, you know, it's pretty, it's where I lived for a number of years. They're a sanctuary city. They were the first declared nuclear free zone. I don't know if anybody's going to respect that if there's ever no, can't come here. Nuclear free. And then mom just stops right now. But there's but we do. I've been holding them there now for 15 years in the children's section. Doesn't keep adults from coming, but it keeps, makes kids feel at home, and it's a beauty to behold. But I truly think that if we can get together with fellow citizens and aspiring citizens in places, in spaces where we feel comfortable, independent bookstores, God, you know, they're fabulous places for that. People will feel, they'll come by and they might see people gathered and feel comfortable enough to come in, I have found, in my sojourns.
Yeah, just sit down.
But those are, it gives me hope and heart. Yes?
I teach at Sonoma State, and the majority of the students I interact with are 18, 19, 20, 21. And we have regularly, in the classes that I'm in, discussion circles. And the openness and civility of these students is astounding. I mean, I'm just so impressed by what they will convey about their own feelings, and at the same time listen to somebody across the way from the circle with complete openness who is having an entirely different point of view. And there is no arguing, there's no crosstalk, there's no raising of voices.
Right.
And it just doesn't cease to impress me as to how wonderful that experience is. So it can be done.
That is wonderful. I mean, what they do, what comes naturally to them was hard won for me. But I felt like, how am I going to change the mode of argument if I can't also be one who's trying to model exploration and inquiry, where it's more about alternative perspective, rather than argument, counter-argument, or like chess moves, you know, because young people think in a world of dazzling colors instead of this black and white and gray. I truly believe, and that's a big part of what my book is about, is that if we are going to flourish on individual and global scales at every age of stage of life, even when we're frail and infirm, we need to have young people in our orbits for lots of different reasons. You know, they have the latest cognitive science studies, and I refer to a lot of them in my book, show that they're hardwired to be empathic. There's probably always exceptions to these rules, but nonetheless, it's something. There was a study that I referred to about adults who, cognitive scientists who drop keys over pillows. Babies will risk life and limb to rescue those keys and give them back. So if by the adult criteria, because these are constructs we invent, that if empathy is to be of help, to be of service in some way, then they will risk it all for those kinds of things. I mean, they reason in different ways, they see the world different. So they have different sets of strengths and different sets of weaknesses. And so I argue strenuously that we need to join forces. There's a guy who I love dearly. He just came out with a book on citizen power. He asked, are there any questions that you'd like to see posed on my channel? And I said, yeah, why can't kids have greater rights to self-determination? Got booted from the page. I'm not there anymore. So this notion that we should include our younger citizens in any way as equals is anathema to even some who consider themselves quite progressive.
At what age do kids lose that? I mean, because obviously there's a transition point because they become...
At what age do kids lose that?
Yeah.
That's the $64 gazillion question. See, I would argue that there is no age at which they should lose it, but that as we begin to imprint more and more on adults, we lose what comes naturally to them. We're in school systems quite often that don't encourage creative, open thinking. Clearly the kids who are in your class somehow managed to circumnavigate and still at that age, which is really cool.
Yeah, but they haven't reached 25 yet, at which point the brain is biologically mature and it stops developing.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you go to my Huffington Post blog, I make all these wacky arguments. It's when kids, like adolescents, it's when the brain is the most malleable. And so I argue that that's exactly when we need to include them in decision making in the civic sphere, because they're much more open to creative problem solving. That quite often, if they are raging bundles of hormones or whatever, it's because we've created a form of fast-paced capitalism that marginalizes them, and they don't have a lot of other things. I mean, Margaret Mead showed when she studied Samoa that that's not the natural state of things at all. That there's alternative forms of adolescence that completely contraindicate what we're contravene what we're saying that adolescents are. I think we're still in the dark ages of understanding a lot of these things. But all my evidence is anecdotal. I mean, I've held literally thousands of inquiries with kids around the globe, everywhere. The pay dirt is with middle school kids. They are at a... They don't have the opportunity in the formal school setting too often to engage in these kinds of inquiries. But when they do, it's jaw-dropping. I mean, they are there, and then something seems to happen as they make their way into the high school years quite often. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with curricula and those kinds of things. All I can say is there's something magical about those adolescent years, especially the earliest adolescent years. In my experience as a philosophical inquirer, and you know, trying to foment more civic participation by them, I do find that they can be more astute than many older folks on the issues. That they're not as impressionable as many older folks are, who are, you know, negative advertising, those kinds of things. But that, at the very least, let's join forces is a big argument I make. Yeah.
One of the other things I tend to think that we're missing in our education, that
was more in the 70s, even at the beginning of the 70s, it kind of started to end, is the natural flow of nature, where we get most of our real truths from. It's where we learn truth.
Tell me more about that.
This is done a personal example. I'm in third grade, really into ornithology, standing on the sidewalk waiting for a bus, and I see birds flying across the street and through the trees. I go, God, how do they do that so fast through all the branches? And I'm watching one goes right into a branch, drops. I run across the street, pick it up, and miss my bus to go home and show my mother the dead bird. I open up my hands and it flies away.
Oh, cool.
It's that. That wow. Instant learning of, like, what I thought, what I believed wasn't true at all. The object of them getting through is still totally amazing to me. But I know that it can be done, and I know it can't be done.
That's beautiful. See, and that still has stayed with you after...
Oh, God, yeah. It's warmed my life, those kind
I can,
of things.
Yeah.
That's
I'm so glad you shared that, because I'll never forget that. That is so cool. Thank you. Yes.
I'm interested in your book. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yes, I can. I did not pay her to say it. This is a really cool give and take. I enjoy this so much. But what would you like? Would you like me to read you a little bit? What would you like?
What is childing?
Well, I'll read you this dialogue I held with elementary school kids in Iowa. And how it launched me on this journey to write this book. Kids enrich and enhance my scholarly inquiries. In fact, all people do. But this one, I would never have written this book if it hadn't been for the fact I was actually giving a presentation at Iowa State University on my Constitution Cafe book. Like, because lots of people made me feel kind of cool. But then a friend of mine I hadn't seen in decades, she asked me, she was an elementary school teacher, and she asked me if I would come speak, not to her kid, but to the class in which her kids were in. And so I didn't. You want to, let me just, should I read that to you? I don't have my glasses. Yeah, I do. Actually, I have these, my magnet. Alright, let me, thank you for putting that. It's really something. I've never dreamed I'd write a book based on that. So it's this is the very first section of Childing, and it's called A Childing We Will Go. And so I've just posed a philosophical oldie but goodie to this group of Ames, Iowa elementary school kids called the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Oh, well, which one did come first? What are your thoughts? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? What?
I don't know the answer to that. Honestly, I'm
intuition.
No opinion.
Hunch.
Yeah.
I think
it seems like the egg.
The
it's
egg.
Not a meaningful question.
Why?
That's not the way that's not the way evolution happens.
So tell me about evolution.
Evolution is a process of it's natural selection where there's change over time. Sometimes that change is very rapid, sometimes it's very slow.
So would there be like pre-egg parts?
No, the question still doesn't sound right.
Still doesn't sound right.
No, the question doesn't sound right.
You're a tough customer. All right.
He's got critical thinking.
Who thinks that, anybody think the egg came first?
I'm the yolk.
Oh, it's Friday night. I can see that. I'll forget it. Just forget it. Anyway.
It all evolved together. Why would you want to put one before?
Yeah, really.
It's a dominator model. The model stinks.
Damn straight. Forget the question.
Yeah.
I'll just toss this book in the can. Well, anyway, let me tell you what
I want to know what the kids said.
Yeah. Well, here I'm going to skip over all my journey to how I started Socrates Cafe, because I've already told you some about that. So this child named Eva, she's 8 years old, says to me after I pose the question, she goes, look, Mr. Phillips, I know we're in Iowa and this is farm country. I don't know the first thing about chickens and eggs. Eva says, I do know something about how human babies are born, because my mom's an obstetrician. She says, if I can refer to Homo sapiens instead of chickens, then I can tell you something about who comes first. So without waiting for my permission, Eva continues in this real schoolmarmish tone. An adult male and female member of the species have to mate in order to fertilize the female's eggs. And by adult, she says, I mean biological ones who can produce eggs and sperms that make babies. And then she looks at her teacher, her third grade teacher, Ms. Bunn, and asks, is it sperm or sperms? She gets no immediate reply from her disconcerted teacher, so she goes on. In real life, it boils down to this. The male has to impregnate the female with one of his sperm. And if the impregnation is by artificial insemination, it still requires a mature male sperm. And once that sperm fuses with one of the female's eggs, the process of fertilization begins. And if everything goes as planned, there's a fertilized egg, keeps dividing in more and more specialized ways until about 9 months later. And you can quit taking notes. a fully developed baby is born. And now Eva turns her attention back to me and says, I have no idea where these first baby makers or chick makers came from. But they had to come first because they are the possessors of the eggs and sperm, or sperms. Unless there is something like, and she struggles with some words she must have learned from her mother, and then I think she was thinking of parthenogenesis. She goes, asexual reproduction. This is a third grade. She then goes on to say, as is the case with flatworms and sharks, where the begetter and begettee are one and the same, that's the one time when they can be both. And this kid named Seth, who's sitting beside her, sort of nods, and he's not sure any more than I am if he's altogether understood Eva, but you can tell he has a little bit of a crush on her, and he's determined to support her. And he goes, and he looks at me and he says, adult chickens and adult humans must have come first, because babies or chicks wouldn't last long without them. And Seth says, once the baby human or chick enters the world, then at least one adult has to be ready to take on the role of parent and raise it. He says, human babies, just like baby chicks, are helpless and defenseless creatures. Someone has to nourish them and watch over them and fend for them, or they're not long for this world. And he says, in the case of humans, sometimes the adult or adults who care for a baby aren't the same ones who make the baby. Sometimes it isn't even an adult, but an older kid. But usually, he says, it's one or more of the original parents, usually. And a child there named Katrina says, Seth's right. Human parents have a job to do. It's called parenting. Raising children from babyhood so they can grow into happy and healthy adults. You don't ever hear anyone talk about childing, do you? And Lauren says, well, there should be a word like childing, because children give birth to parents. There wouldn't be parents without children. Not only that, children raise parents. My mom and dad tell me that I raise them, and they learn important life lessons from me. They say I help them grow all the time as human beings. And so now their teacher, Ms. Bunn, inserts herself, and she says, children don't just raise their own parents. They raise all of us adults, privileged enough to be part of their lives. And she says, she turns her attention to me and she says, early in the year I'd shared the joyful news with my students that I was expecting a child. When I had a miscarriage, I tried to think of how to tell them, and I kept putting it off. And then one by one, each of my students came up to me in a private moment. They knew just what to say and what not to say. She said several told me their moms had had miscarriages but then went on to have babies. She says, I found strength and comfort in their gestures, and they lifted me up from sorrow. I learned a great deal from how my students reached out to me about how I can reach out to others in their own time of need. And so we sit in a comfortable silence for a while until Eva says, you know, my parents aren't the only ones who raise me. My teacher raises me too, and other adults do too. She goes, there should be a word to describe that. Adulting! You know, there's... Yeah, I'll take one. And then Eva thinks some more. She goes, my friends raise me too. They stand up for me, protect me. They gently criticize me if I'm not being kind. And they're like an extended part of my family. This brings Lauren to say now, when it comes to raising one another, we're all in this together, children and adults. We need one another to make sure we don't shrivel like raisins. And this inspires Seth to say, does that mean we all come first? So that's, I'll read you just a little bit more so you'll know the trajectory this book takes. It's a philosophical approach to human flourishing. Typically, most books on this subject are from social sciences, but mine's more of a philosophical bent. But I asked myself, I said, are these kids onto something? Because many adults speak in glowing terms about how their lives are incalculably changed and enhanced by the youngest among us. But do we really, really consider in our heart of hearts our brethren at the other end of the age spectrum, our peers in matters of raising one another? Or do our actions sometimes belie our words? So I enter the word. I go home and I enter the word adulting in my spell check, and it tells me there's no such thing. There is no word so far of adulting. But then I type in the word childing. And lo and behold, Merriam-Webster shows that there is such a word, and it's been around for centuries. Fell out of favor a long time ago. Childing first arrived on the scene around 1250 AD. According to Merriam-Webster, the word denotes being pregnant or bearing a child. A poet named Robert Southey used the word in his stirring poem, The Battle of Blenheim. I won't read all of it to you, but he goes, with fire and sword, the country round was wasted far and wide, and many a childing mother than a newborn baby died. But things like that, you know, must be at every famous victory. And about a century before childing, William Shakespeare, y'all heard of him? Shakespeare. He made matchless use of the term in A Midsummer Night's Dream. How do you pronounce it? Oberon? Do I pronounce it right? I'm autodidact, so sometimes I don't know if what I... And Titania? The king and queen of the fairies are engaged in a torrential tiff over whether a little boy from India whom Titania has taken under her wing and mothered since infancy belongs to her or to Oberon, who refers to the boy as his charm and a mere trifle. Well, the acrimonious barbs the immortals hurl at one another reach such a crescendo that Mother Nature herself is thrown out of kilter. And when Titania takes a moment to catch her breath from her argument with Oberon, she surveys the aftermath. The childing autumn, angry winter, change their wonted liveries, and the mazed world by their increase now knows not which is which. And this some progeny, and this same progeny of evils come from our debate, from our dissension. We are their parents and original. So just when autumn is aborning, winter muscles its discontented way into the picture. And not only have Titania and Oberon managed to upend the order of the seasons, but they stirred autumn and winter into such a frenzy that it's impossible to pry the two apart. And Titania acknowledges that she and Oberon have childed this mayhem. So the cautionary tale is, be mindful of your actions, lest you child in unintended, if not disastrous, ways. Well, I do some more digging, and I unearth an old edition of Collins' American Dictionary, and find still another definition of childing, bearing a cluster of newer blossoms around an older blossom. And it occurred to me that such a rendering, if applied to the human condition, would indicate that there's no shedding of the old as we add the new, but a continual superadding of the new to the old. And if that is true, as I believe it is, how can we best see to it that we blossom like flowers rather than shrivel like raisins? And so, as Lauren had put it in the dialogue, and I started developing what just seemed to be this culminating philosophy of childing, had built on all of my work over the years with what I call children of all ages. Because when you come to one of these gatherings, you sort of turn on those childlike questioning lenses again. I argue, I assert in the book, I say, never before has our culture been as child-centric as it is today. And yet never before has childhood often been as strained and pinched. Its serendipity and spontaneity is fast disappearing in our heavily vocationalized, overscheduled culture. Kids are expected to be adults in training and to be thinking about college by the time they're in third grade. I didn't start thinking about college till my junior year. Okay. To the extent that we bought into this hyper-utilitarian notion of childhood, we not only potentially do tremendous damage to kids, but to ourselves as adults, by severely constricting our possibilities for being all that we can be. And I ask, what if in order to see further in matters of human prospering, we must stand at times on the shoulders of our youngest? And what if kids are giants when it comes to being paragons who can help us chart ground-breaking paths of seeing and being and doing? And so I felt like a philosophy of childing was called for, which amounts to a systematic philosophical take grounded in powerful evidence from the human sciences about how we should treat children and what we can learn from the way young people process the world. Because in matters of human flourishing, I find that we at times should take our cue from those with the least number of physical years under their belt. This is based on the perhaps unsettling assertion that without the able assistance and guidance of kids, we adults at times can shrink mentally and emotionally and cognitively with the passage of time. If we're not vigilant, our sense of who we are can actually become fuzzier over time, diminishing our prospects for further development. We can return the favor to kids in spades by ensuring that our youngest also have full and ample opportunity to flourish from a healthy core. Because when we do, they return the favor to us. So we can greatly expand our horizons regarding our development by taking potentially a radically different approach to the boundaries between childhood and adulthood, and paying far more attention to the former. And by doing so, perhaps we can sustain our development along the meteoric lines with which it began, rather than let it lapse, as it sometimes does, into apathy and bitterness, and even dullness as we've become adults. I go into a lot of other things, but I say, to better understand our potential for childing, I also convene hither and yon with people of many ages and in many stages of life who have an unquenchable love of asking why. Because it's my experience through Socrates Cafe, Democracy Cafe, and such, that it's in a certain kind of group setting with a method of inquiry that requires the sustained and thoughtful consideration of a variety of objections and alternatives to any given point of view that we can frequently hash out our highest ideas, our values, our visions for ourselves and one another. And in this case, about how we best unfold. As always, my objective in this book, as in all my others, is not to come up with the last word, but rather to present promising new vantage points for consideration. In the acclaimed journals of Anaïs Nin, which she began writing at age 11, she observes that, quote unquote, some people remind me of sharp, dazzling diamonds, valuable but lifeless and loveless. Others of the simplest field flowers, with hearts full of dew, and with all the tints of celestial beauty reflected in their modest petals. And she makes clear her preference for the latter, whom she says have a warmth and a softness that's lacking in those with mere brilliancy and coldness, who are both the willful parents and originators of a host of ills. By all outward appearances, they may have grown up and out in brilliant fashion, but as we know, appearances are deceived. So I ask throughout this book, as I examine human rightness and rottenness, human identity, human play at all ages and stages of life, human reason, how can we child one another so that we are not crushed into diamonds but are able to flourish? And so I set off in search of promising answers. And I did so as a husband and a father of a young family who's devoted his life to building on making my modest efforts to help this world become a bit more livable and lovable, so that those with hearts full of dew and with all the tints of celestial beauty reflected in their modest petals can shine. So that's what childing is all about. So thanks for asking about that. Thank you. The time flies when you're philosophizing.
Is that one of your kids on the cover?
Huh?
Is that one of your kids on the
cover? It's not. It's not the slightest hair right here. I'll show you my kids. Okay, they're right here. So everybody, thank you for coming. If you'd like me to sign any of my books, I'm very happy to do so. And I'm very honored to have been invited here, and I hope we cross paths again. Feel free to write to me, Christopher_Phillips, 2 L's, at mac.com. But thanks so much for coming.
I'd also like to take one moment to remind everybody that every month, on the third Monday of the month, we have a Democracy Cafe right here in the
Thanks
store.
Thanks to him. And other than there's a reason that's got me here, it's very serendipitous. Thank you to Jim and Rob for having me. Thank you.
I'd like to sign that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is your name?
Jean, J-E-A-N-N-E.
J-E-A-N-N-E. Thank you.